Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Medical Update on Pancreatic Cancer. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 912 participants, so there's a lot of you on the call from all over the United States, from all different regions of this country. And we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Kenya, Korea, Saudi Arabia, and the UK. So you're really from all over the world. And it's really, it's a credit to you that you're spending the next hour with us. Now, today's program was made possible by an educational grant from Astellas Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, you received information from Cancer Care, and in that information, there is, in those packets and materials you received, there is information about our speakers and the topics they'll be covering, and all the different collaborating organizations as resources. Now, there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you all to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you would like us to offer. Indeed, we are trying very hard to offer a program on pancreatic cancer at least once or twice a year, and that's really based on the feedback that we receive from you in the evaluations. So please tell us what you'd like us to offer, and we'll try very hard to implement your suggestions in our programs coming up. And we have a new year coming next year, so we'll be doing many more programs, and so really welcome your suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Eileen O'Reilly. And Dr. O'Reilly is Associate Member, GI Medical Oncology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And she's Associate Professor, Weill Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. O'Reilly is going to address an overview of pancreatic cancer, current standard of care, communicating with the healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. O'Reilly.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for the introduction, and welcome to the call, and good afternoon from New York. So to sort of lead us to the meat of the topic, just to emphasize that the conference today is focused mostly on adenocarcinoma, which is a subtype and the most common type of pancreatic malignancies. We're certainly happy to take questions on neuroendocrine cancer of the pancreas, but again, our discussion is focused on adenocarcinoma. So in North America, we see about 40,000 new people diagnosed with this disease each year. And it tends to occur more commonly as we all get older. The average age is in the early 70s. For many people, we don't understand why they develop this cancer, but there are a couple of recognize things. One, its association with smoking, and in fact, about a third of pancreas cancers, that's perhaps the major underlying contributor. Other considerations include family history of pancreas cancer or related malignancies such as breast, ovary, prostate, endometrial cancer. That's in a small subset of people, but a subset that's important both potentially from the screening perspective and possibly because of treatment implications. Pancreas cancer can present in a variety of different ways, but a common consideration or a common presentation would be people notice that their urine gets dark, they start to itch, maybe become jaundiced, their family members notice that, or they've noticed their appetite has diminished, may have lost some weight, may feel full quickly, or perhaps some abdominal pain, bloating, or back pain. And those symptoms can be sort of insidious and evolve over a period of time. And that's actually one of the characteristics of pancreas cancer, that often when it is diagnosed, it has spread beyond the local area. And that would be true for about two-thirds or more of people in whom the disease is diagnosed. From the medical perspective, we think about three groupings: those in whom the cancer is localized, where surgery would be consideration; those in whom the cancer is localized also, but is involving key blood vessels, and it's not possible, at least at the time of the initial assessment, to proceed with an operation. And then the largest group of people where the cancer is spread, and the main areas that pancreas cancer tends to involve are the liver, lymph nodes in the abdominal cavity, the inner lining of the abdominal cavity, which can sometimes result in fluid collection, and sometimes in the lungs, and less commonly in the bones and other areas. So that sort of staging defines what typically would be the ways that we would approach it from the treatment perspective. And for people who have localized pancreas cancer, the diagnosis is made with a combination of the clinical assessment and imaging and typically a biopsy. So one of the ways that we would stage the cancer would be to do a high-quality CAT scan, drinking oral contrast and IV contrast, and then looking to see what the relationship of the tumor to blood vessels is, to see whether there's any spread of the cancer. And you can get usually a good sense of what the treatment plan is going to be by looking at the imaging. For people who have jaundice, typically a stent is required, and mostly these days that involves putting in a metal, like chicken mesh, that's placed into the bile duct that's done via a procedure called an ERCP, which is an outpatient procedure. It's like an upper endoscopy, and that typically relieves the blockage in the bile duct and restores the color of the urine, bowels, and the skin. And at the same time, in a related procedure called an endoscopic ultrasound, a needle sample can be taken of the pancreas to confirm the diagnosis. So increasingly these days, that's the main tool that we use to actually confirm in black and white what type of cancer is present and to distinguish it from other types of pancreas malignancies, particularly something called neuroendocrine cancer, which is a distinct treatment approach and somewhat different prognosis going forward. So for a person who has localized disease, there are two main considerations, and perhaps the more common consideration would be to take that person directly to surgery. And for tumors that arise in the head or the center portion, the main portion of the pancreas, that operation is called a Whipple surgery, which is a major operation involving taking out the head of the pancreas, part of the bile duct, part of the small bowel, the gallbladder, and rejoining the plumbing together. And there's usually a 4 to 6 week recuperation period after that. And then typically a person would follow on with post-operative treatment. That's called adjuvant treatment, where the goals are to try and eliminate any microscopic cells that could be lurking and to try and improve the outcome of the cancer. For the second group of patients that we mentioned who have disease which is localized and involving blood vessels but not operable, the main approaches in terms of treatment would be what we call systemic therapy or chemotherapy, which could be a combination of 1, 2, and sometimes 3 drugs, and often followed on going forward by a combination of both chemotherapy and radiation. In a percentage of people with localized pancreas cancer where there are blood vessel involvement, it may be possible, depending on the extent of that blood vessel involvement and depending on how that person's cancer benefits from the treatment, to revisit the idea of surgery. And there's a subgroup of people in there who are termed borderline resectable, where there's potential for an operation going forward. That's not a big group of people, but it's a real group of people, and it's an area where there's sort of a lot of work being focused on in terms of defining the characteristics of that group of people and defining how best to treat that group of people. So for most patients, as we mentioned, they do come to medical attention when their cancer has spread. And a common question that comes up is, why is that so? And it's not well understood, but in many contexts, pancreas cancer is sort of sneaky and rather silent in its behavior, and that there may not be obvious early warning signs, and that can be particularly true if the disease arises in the left side of the pancreas, which is called the body or the tail, where there's no bile duct and people don't tend to develop jaundice, so that may be part of the reason that the presentation is a little later, but also just the underlying behavior of the cancer itself dictates that. So for people who have metastatic disease or pancreas cancer which has spread, chemotherapy-based treatments and clinical trials and a variety of supportive measures that Dr. Varadachari and will go on to speak to in a few minutes are integrated as part of treatment. The main drugs that are utilized are gemcitabine, which is a well-established medication that's been FDA approved now for about 14 years or so in the treatment of pancreas cancer, and it's often combined with a second medication, and that would be a commonly used treatment approach. Relatively recently, another combination of medications called FOLFIRINOX, which involves something called 5-FU, irinotecan, oxaliplatin, and a vitamin called leucovorin, has become established and increasingly integrated as part of the initial treatment for people with pancreas cancer if their level of well-being is high, because this combination has shown to have particular value in that setting. It does come perhaps with an extra burden of side effects that always has to be weighed up on an individual basis as to whether that's the right fit for that particular person. And one of the points that we would like to emphasize is that clinical trials hold a very important consideration when weighing up treatment options for pancreas cancer, as that's how the drugs that are currently established have been developed, and it's how one hopes to continue to make progress in this disease by integrating new medications. And there are a lot of clinical trials in development, although we would say there are never enough for all of the patients that could potentially benefit from participation. So I'll stop there, and just before passing on to Dr. Varadachari, just focus on two other topics briefly in terms of communicating with your healthcare team. So as an individual with this disease or as a spokesperson for the family, I think it's good to nominate somebody in the family to be the main person or channel of communication with the healthcare team so that there's consistent flow back and forth of information. It's very helpful always to write down your concerns and to perhaps to prioritize your concerns and questions. As time is a precious resource for all of us, patients, families, and medical staff alike, to make sure that your key questions are addressed at the time of the office visits. I think, to be way up on an individual basis, you know, what the options are, and to take some time to consider those. One doesn't necessarily need to make an immediate decision in terms of what's the best way to proceed. And sometimes it's helpful to think about a second opinion from a specialized pancreas cancer center to help guide the direction of care, as there may be certain nuances that in community-based practices aren't always available. And I think particularly with regard to interventive procedures and surgery and radiation, where it's done and how it's done and the quality control of those interventions has been shown to be important in terms of outcomes in this disease. And then to conclude for this part, quality of life considerations are an extremely important aspect for looking after people with pancreas cancer. And it's one of the things as medical oncologists and professionals taking care of people with this disease that we try and weigh up every time we make a decision as to, you know, how this is going to impact on quality of life. And is this really the best fit for that particular person given their specifics and their background medical issues and their philosophy and goals of care? So we always try and factor that in. in general, if the cancer is responding, quality of life tends to be better. Quality of life becomes an increasingly challenging consideration, often as the disease evolves, and that's where, you know, multidisciplinary management from medical oncology, surgical teams, gastroenterology, social work, nutritional support, and pain and palliative care resources have very meaningful contributions to help in terms of this disease. So thank you. I'll pass on here to Dr. Varadachari.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Reilly, for just an excellent, really excellent overview and presentation, and a lot of excellent information about the treatment for pancreatic cancer as well. Our next speaker is Dr. Gauri Varadachari, and Dr. Varadachari is Associate Professor, Department of Gastrointestinal Medical Oncology, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and she will be addressing new treatment approaches, clinical trial updates, pain and symptom management, and managing weight loss. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Varadachari.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. O'Reilly, as well. Hello, everyone, and thanks for the introduction. I would like to start with providing an overview of what the clinical trials involve and some of the terminology we use, and a quick update. As you all know, only through innovative research will we be able to make large strides for this challenging disease, and research itself contributes to treatment options for our patients. Now, there is an overwhelming amount of information on the Internet, and it may be very helpful if one navigates the system successfully, but more often I hear from my patients tell me that there is too much information and they can feel quite lost, and it may also be difficult to distinguish, like Dr. O'Reilly said, what exactly refers to pancreatic adenocarcinoma versus neuroendocrine cancer on the Internet. Let me first start by discussing the three phases of a clinical trial. There's a phase four as well, but it's not too relevant for our discussion today. So phase one trials are important, and it's important to know about this because pancreatic cancer patients who are candidates may be offered a phase one or a phase two trial. A phase one trial is the earliest trial in the life of a new drug or treatment. They are usually smaller trials with less than 30 patients, though that trend is changing in the last 2 years. The trial may be open to patients with any type of cancer, so not just pancreatic adenocarcinoma. And this phase trial is done to build on what we have learned from the laboratory, the bench research, the cell studies, and the animal studies. Patients entering phase one trials often have advanced cancer and have usually undergone standard treatment options available to them. The aim of a phase one trial is to look for a safe dose range for a new drug and side effects, and patients may not benefit from the treatment, and it's important to know that. Phase one trials, though, are very important because they are the first step in finding new treatment options for our patients, and all the drugs we have today have gone through a phase one step. Now, phase two trials are done to find out if the new treatment for pancreatic cancer works well enough to test it in a larger phase three trial, and to learn a bit more about the side effects and how we manage them and the best dose going forward. Phase two trials are usually larger than phase one, and there may be up to 100 patients or more taking part in a phase two trial. Nowadays, most pancreatic cancer phase two trials are not really single arm, but tend to be randomized, which is a good trend, which means, again, you are taking an experimental option and comparing it with standard of care. And patients are randomized into these two groups, and this happens after the patient signs up for a trial. I want to mention a word or two on predictive biomarkers because this terminology comes up as well. So we are seeing more predictive biomarker enriched study designs in pancreatic cancer in the phase one and phase two setting. So what does that mean? A predictive biomarker helps us assess or predict the most likely response to a particular treatment type, because the question we've been asking ourselves in the pancreatic cancer community is whether the drug that we earlier testing failed us, or did we fail the new drug by not studying it in the right patient population? And in the last several years, there is a lot of interest in understanding which drug is a good fit for which patient, instead of expecting a one-treatment-fit-all strategy. Even now, we still need to get a better understanding on which patients are the best candidates for the three-drug new regimen that Dr. O'Reilly referred to, FOLFIRINOX, versus the gemcitabine-based regimen or some other drugs. So there is an interest in understanding the genetic makeup of a patient's cancer and then using the right drug. Phase 3 trials. These trials compare the new treatments with the currently best available treatment, the standard treatment. Phase 3 trials are usually large trials with several hundred patients and are randomized. One group gets the new treatment and the other gets the standard treatment. And again, this is done randomly after the patient signs up for the study. I wanted to give a quick update on an exciting phase 3 trial press release that just came out about 2 weeks ago. Celgene, which is a drug company, released some information on their trial with gemcitabine and nab-paclitaxel, a combination comparing it to gemcitabine alone. And the study shows that this combination does better than gemcitabine alone. We do not have any information yet about the degree of benefit, and the data will be reported in a medical conference in January. But we are excited that there may be more options for our patients in the near future. So bottom line, there are many trials, more than 100 enrolling right now for pancreatic adenocarcinoma to study novel therapies. Some of the websites to consider include www.cancer.gov, www.clinicaltrials.gov. You can go to pancan.org. And most importantly, talk to your doctor about your options. And some of the questions that you can ask your doctor about clinical trials are which phase trial is being offered to me. Like I just told you, there are several phases. What are the side effects of the new drug being offered? Are they different from the current non-trial option being offered to me? Can I stop the trial anytime? How often are blood tests going to be done? Do I need a line or a portacap? Will my insurance pay for the expenses involved? And are there any special instructions for my family members? Bottom line, it's important that you feel comfortable signing up for the research study, and the clinical trial group needs to spend enough time explaining to you what the trial is about. Let's switch gear and talk a bit about symptom control in pancreatic cancer and pain control. Advanced pancreatic adenocarcinoma causes pain in many patients, but it is important to note that cancer pain can be managed very effectively in most patients with pancreatic cancer. The severity and the prevalence of the pain does depend on several factors: the position of the tumor, the stage of the cancer, the location of metastases. And as we are all aware, pain can affect each person differently. We also know that depression, poor sleep, fatigue, anxiety, nausea can lower the pain threshold. The doctor's goal for pain management is twofold. One, to make the patient pain-free. And second, to make the patient as functional as possible on the current medications. And the approaches we use are classified in the medical terminology as pharmacological, which is use of pills, and non-pharmacological. Our pharmacological pain control involves use of painkillers, and most pancreatic cancer patients who have significant pain do use narcotics as part of their pain therapy. There are side effects to this, and it's important to discuss that with your doctor, including nausea, constipation, sedation, urinary retention, and itching. And as doctors, we have to educate our patients regarding these side effects and prescribe additional drugs to manage these side effects. So it's really important to manage the constipation, and it can be done well, to have an aggressive bowel regimen with narcotics. Now, some some patients with pancreatic cancer may be candidates for a procedure called as a celiac nerve block. So these are the non-pharmacological options for our pain management. These patients where there is involvement of the celiac axis, which is an important artery around the pancreas, they can present with back pain. It's like a band-like sensation that they complain of, and narcotics sometimes may not help. An outpatient procedure done by a pain team may be helpful. It's either alcohol or phenol that they administer into that nerve node through the vertebral body, and this can help reduce the need for narcotics in some patients. There are additional approaches one can use for pain control. Radiation in selected patients may be beneficial, especially if the pain is coming from the bone metastases or the primary tumor. Rarely in selected patients, there are neurosurgical techniques that could be used, including an epidural pump. But in my practice, I would say we rarely, if ever, use epidural pumps and really do not need that given some of the other options that I just discussed with you. Let's talk a bit about some of the other troubling symptoms, jaundice, blockage of the intestines, fluid buildup, and weight loss. So jaundice can develop from blockage of bile ducts. There are other situations one can have jaundice where there is no liver reserve because of metastases. But let's talk about blockage of the bile duct because we do see that commonly. Patients present with yellowing of skin, eyes, urine, and loss of appetite. They can have nausea and itching. And in patients with advanced pancreatic adenocarcinoma where the jaundice is clearly due to blockage of the bile duct, we proceed with insertion of a tube called a stent. It's often a metal stent, but also a plastic stent is put in by a gastroenterologist, and it's inserted into the bile duct to allow drainage of bile into the intestine. And after the stent placement, if the patient has any fever or abdominal pain or recurrence of jaundice, it is important to report it to your doctor because it may be related to an infection in the stent or maybe the stent is malfunctioning. Another symptom that we are concerned about with our patients with nausea, vomiting is blockage. The tumor itself or the growth of the tumor invading into the nerves around the stomach or intestines can cause blockage of the duodenum, which is the first part of the intestine or the stomach, and we call this gastroparesis. And this can lead to difficulty in eating and persistent vomiting. And based on the patient's situation, where they are with their cancer stage, based on where they are with their therapies, responding, not responding, the ability to handle procedures, we then consider options. These could be tubes to vent or release the gastric juices. It could be a stent to open up the blockage, or even surgical bypass in selected patients if the cancer has not metastasized. Another symptom that we do come across is ascites. This is fluid buildup in the abdomen, and this can cause a bloating and weight gain. So it's not good weight gain, it's fluid weight gain. So as a doctor, we keep an eye on that. And we remove the fluid by administering a needle and a catheter into the abdomen. And if it returns quickly and if the need for removing the fluid is frequent, we sometimes have to consider a permanent catheter placement and teach our patients and their families to drain this fluid either daily or every other day based on their need. I would like to close by going into some discussion about weight loss because it is a definite concern for our patients and also to the doctors. We check our patients' weight each visit, and there are several reasons a patient may lose weight, including chemotherapy-induced nausea, loss of appetite, no taste, pancreatic insufficiency, and Maria Petzl will discuss this next, and depression. And there is research underway to manage cancer cachexia. Now, this is tumor-induced weight loss, and it is a concern in pancreatic cancer. We know that pancreatic cancer tumors release chemicals called cytokines in the blood, and these cytokines cause the body to burn more calories, break down muscle protein, and can also decrease one's appetite. We are currently looking at drugs that block these cytokines, and Maria will talk about managing weight loss, especially after Whipple surgery. But what I do want to mention is that as oncologists, after we review our patients' chemotherapy side effects and make changes based on their symptoms, if their weight loss or poor appetite persists, we sometimes do consider medications. And we have two or three that we look at. One includes mirtazapine. This is an antidepressant, but it has an appetite-building effect, also called Remeron. In some patients, if they have nausea and poor appetite, we can try dronabinol, which is like a medicated marijuana, Marinol, or even a short course of steroids. We also have progesterone hormones called Megase, but we use that cautiously given that it can cause fluid gain and blood clots in pancreatic cancer patients. So I'm going to stop here. I hope I have been able to give you some information on treatments we have for symptom control in pancreatic cancer. Most importantly, discuss this on a regular basis with your doctor. Some symptoms are very subjective, and it requires you to discuss it so that the best treatment options and supportive therapies can be offered to you. I thank you for your attention.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Bhattachary, for a very comprehensive and very compassionate presentation on the new treatment approaches as well as the pain and symptom management. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Ms. Maria Petzl. And Ms. Petzl is Senior Clinical Dietitian, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Petzl is going to address nutritional concerns and eating hints. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Petzl.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity to be a part of this call, and thank you all for taking time out of your day to listen to us. With regards to nutrition, in general, our goals with nutrition are to prevent or reverse poor nutrition, to maintain dose and schedule of cancer treatments, to manage symptoms, maintain or improve weight and strength, and to maximize quality of life. Some common concerns for patients with pancreatic cancer are weight loss, also diarrhea, pancreatic enzymes, and then just what to eat in general. As Dr. Bhattachary talked about, the different causes of weight loss can include tumor-induced weight loss. It can also include malabsorption, which is pancreatic enzyme insufficiency, or just inadequate intake due to the side effects of treatment, including poor appetite, taste changes, early satiety, or nausea and vomiting. General tips to help manage these side effects of treatment, especially poor appetite, nausea, early satiety, or feeling full really quickly, include eating small, frequent meals, aiming to break your normal three meals a day up into 6 to 8 smaller meals a day. Planning meals and snacks the day before. There can be a lot of stress when it's mealtime and your loved one can't tell you what they're interested in eating or they don't have a good appetite. So actually sitting down each day in the evening and planning mealtimes, snack times, and what those actual meals and snacks will be, and then serving those meals and snacks on the schedule. And this will help provide more calories and more protein as the day goes on rather than just eating as desired. It's important to get plenty of fluids. Most patients are going to need between 6 and 8 cups of fluid per day. Also, a patient's tolerance of fat will vary. Some patients will need to limit their portions or their use of fat-containing foods. Others will have no problems tolerating higher fat foods. So this is really an individual basis. It is important to choose nutrient-dense foods. You want foods that are going to be good sources of calories and protein and vitamins and minerals. Trying to limit the foods that are high in sugar and simple calories that are not really complex and don't have good protein to go along with them. It's also important to be active. Activity can help stimulate the appetite. It can help with maintaining regular bowel movements. And it can help with feelings of early satiety. It can help actually the food move through the GI tract. I want to just pay a little closer attention to nutrition tips for diarrhea. So regardless of the cause of diarrhea, whether it's chemotherapy induced or if it's related to radiation, medications, these tips are all the same. So with patients that are experiencing diarrhea, it can be important or helpful to avoid lactose or lactose-containing foods. These are going to be things like milk or cheese. Or if these are really an important source of calories and protein in your diet, then using lactase enzymes, which is an over-the-counter product, and this can help break down the lactose that could contribute to diarrhea. If patients are experiencing diarrhea, they should decrease insoluble fiber. Insoluble fiber is found in whole grains, in high-fiber cereals, in fruits, the peels of fruits and vegetables. So when somebody's experiencing diarrhea, we will often have them decrease their use of raw fruits and vegetables, peel the skin off of these vegetables, and avoid things like bran cereals or other high-fiber grain foods. Also, reducing foods that are sweetened with sugar alcohols. So sorbitol and mannitol are two common sugar alcohols. And just sugar-sweetened beverages in general can move very rapidly through the system and create more diarrhea. Things that patients can do more of and eat more of to help flow the diarrhea, to help gel the stool, are to eat more soluble fiber. So soluble fiber is found in the inside of the apple, so apple without the peel or applesauce, bananas, oats, and citrus without the membrane. These are great sources of soluble fiber that can help gel the stool. Also, when somebody's having significant amounts of diarrhea, they will lose potassium and sodium, so including good sources of potassium and sodium foods in the diet, and really making sure to stay adequately hydrated. Oftentimes, the use of children's electrolyte drinks like Pedialyte or oral rehydration solutions and even diluted sports drinks such as Gatorade or G2 can be really good replacements for fluids when somebody's having diarrhea. Diarrhea can be related to digestive insufficiency or malabsorption. So in general, the symptoms of pancreatic enzyme insufficiency are feelings of indigestion, cramping after meals, bloating after meals, passing large amounts of gas, having very foul-smelling gas or stools, having floating stools or greasy, fatty stools, frequent stools, and also unexplained weight loss. Now, these can present all together, or a patient may have one or two of these symptoms. It's important if somebody is taking pain medication, which is typically constipating, if they have some of the symptoms of gas and bloating, but not necessarily the changes in bowel movements, we should work with your medical team to evaluate if they may still benefit from pancreatic enzymes. So if somebody has digestive insufficiency, we would treat this by prescribing pancreatic enzymes. Now, pancreatic enzymes are the same enzymes that your pancreas makes. It's just in a pill form, so we deliver it with the food rather than depending on the pancreas to produce enough or get enough enzymes to the food when necessary. Enzymes are individual, so one patient will do better with one brand versus another, and everybody's dose is slightly different. So the important part is to find the brand and the dose that works for you and stick with that. The amount of enzymes that somebody will need is going to vary depending on the disease, the treatment, and also the amount of fat in the diet. So real quickly, what should we eat? What should we be working with our family members, our patients, our loved ones to be eating? It's important to get adequate protein. Protein needs are a little bit elevated with cancer. They're certainly elevated after surgery during the healing phase, and they can be elevated during chemotherapy and radiation and other treatments as well. So it's important to get lean cuts of meat, beans, peas, lentils as tolerated, using low-fat or fat-free sources of dairy products. Also, eggs are a great source of protein. There are milk and milk alternatives, so things like soy milk, rice milk, hemp milk, and then also meat alternatives, so tofu, veggie burgers, or using protein powders to make your own smoothies or fortify foods that you're eating. And finally, nuts and seeds are great sources of protein. Fruits, vegetables, and carbohydrates, complex carbohydrates, bread, cereals, etc., can provide good sources of calories. And then again, fats as tolerated are going to be a good source of calories. Trying to use more healthier fats like olive oil, canola oil, peanut oil, also avocado, olives, and nuts and seeds, should be used preferentially over things like butter or margarine or standard vegetable oil, but certainly using fats as tolerated can be a good way to get more calories into the diet. Finally, as Dr. O'Reilly and Dr. Bhattacharya have mentioned, there's some great resources, and Dr. Besner mentioned in your packet that there is a list of collaborating groups. Included in this is the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. They actually have a comprehensive booklet about diet and nutrition that is available for free, and it's important to seek out a registered dietitian. You can ask for a consult at your cancer center. If there's not a dietitian available at your cancer center, you can contact Cancer Care for guidance on finding a dietitian who specializes in oncology. So thank you for your time, and I'll turn it back over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Maria, for an excellent, really outstanding presentation. Lots of tips for everybody, and this is always such an important area for everyone, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra, and Liz is an oncology social worker, and she's program coordinator for Cancer Care. And Ms. Ezra is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with pancreatic cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's programs, including individual counseling, support groups, either over the phone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situation or have similar problems. These connections can help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you deal better with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a person with pancreatic cancer telephone support group and also an online group for people with pancreatic cancer and their caregivers. We also have a unique young adult with cancer online group and also a unique online group for their caregivers. If you are interested in any of the Cancer Care services, please call our helpline at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673 or on our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. As we have learned a lot from today's program, and there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around, our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information that you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Well, thank you very much, Liz, for that really wonderful presentation and also for describing so eloquently the services of cancer care and also the role of the support groups. And thank you. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask that Stephanie bring all of our speakers on board so that we can take as many of your questions as possible. And Stephanie will explain to all of you how to queue up for questions, and we'll take as many of them as we can. If we don't get to your question, please call our 800 number at the end of the call, 1-800-813-HOPE. But let's see how many we can take now. Perhaps we can get to them all. Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Letitia J. Your line is open.
Hi, yes. My father-in-law has just recently been diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, adenocarcinoma, with mets to the liver. We are 1 month and 3 days into this. They've pretty much given him maybe a couple of more weeks left. They've tried two-thirds of a Gemzar chemo. He can't handle it. His platelets have dropped really low. And so we're sending him home with hospice. They thought maybe a gallbladder was going bad, but what it is the celiac branch of nerves. The tumor is resting on that nerve.
And did you have a question?
The question is, the platelets are starting to come back up. With him being in the last stage here, is there any hope for that celiac plexus block at this point for helping with this pain that he's having?
Well, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Bhattachary if you could address that question.
Sure. Sorry about your father-in-law's condition. The main question about the block is whether the pain is coming from the celiac impingement or whether it's from the metastases and stretch of the liver capsule. So it's really important to for the healthcare team to pinpoint the cause of pain. If the pain is mainly a band-like back pain and it seems that the primary tumor is large and that's where most of the pain is, perhaps he may benefit from the block, but that is an invasive procedure. It does require conscious sedation, kind of anesthesia, and the patient needs to be safely done. If the pain is more generalized all over the abdomen or right shoulder, and it's really not all that clear that the pain is clearly from the celiac block, we really do not want to go in and do an invasive procedure, and it may not help him if the pain is coming from the liver. So that's the first distinction that needs to be made. And secondly, review the narcotic program and see whether all the medications have been optimized.
Could you say a word about that? Probably many people on the call wondering in terms of the various just levels of pain medications that are available or the combination of medicines that can be used, and this patient is with the hospice team. So could you say a bit about that?
Sure, absolutely. So sometimes there's no need for narcotic pain medications, and the patients can do with analgesics, and that would be using Tylenol or ibuprofen-like medications in the appropriate patients if the platelet counts are okay and if there is no bleeding. There are adjuncts sometimes added to these analgesics, which are medications like certain antidepressants, which can help with nerve pain, like it's called Neurontin or Gabapentin. Lyrica is another medication that's used. Steroids are helpful as pain medications. So once we go away from these non-narcotics, then we come to the narcotic pain medications. With narcotics, we look at short-acting narcotics. These are called breakthrough medicines that we can use every 2 to 4 hours, depending on the level of pain. And they work within minutes and can work anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. But if the need for that medication is significant and patients take more than 4 or close to 6-8 of these pills or more than that, and it only takes the edge off and they don't have pain relief, then one needs a long-acting pain medication. These are time-release pain medications. They have small pores that release medication over a period of time, and they are used twice a day. On a regular basis. Sometimes it can be a pill, sometimes it's a patch that's changed every 3 days. So the narcotic pain medications are typically long-acting and short-acting. And based on the need, the short-acting doses are adjusted or vice versa.
Excellent. And also, I would recommend that you also talk with the hospice team in detail, all the different levels of team members. There usually is a social worker on the team, an oncology nurse. There's a pain physician that you can really go over all of this with. And, of course, you certainly can take advantage of the services of Cancer Care as well to help you deal with your father-in-law and the family issues as well that you're dealing with. So thank you for your question. But we are here for you, and you can certainly call us after the call as well. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Mike S. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Mike. Do you have a question?
Oh, hello. Yes. I have a quick question. My mother, stage 4 pancreatic cancer, metastasized to the liver. They have been trying a microbiotic diet, and I have read this is, macrobiotic diet, and I have read this is not a good idea. Just with regard to protein and calories, and I'm just curious what your opinion or the specialist's opinion are on the matter.
Thank you for that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Bhattacharya if you could just address that in a general way, and then we'll ask you then, Mike, to take that back to your treating healthcare team. But Dr. Bhattacharya, could you comment on that?
Mike, could you give me a bit of an idea of exactly what is recommended as part of a macrobiotic diet?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I could cover this if you'd like. This is Maria.
Maria,
go ahead,
course.
Maria.
Of
so course. A macrobiotic diet definitely can be deficient in nutrients, protein, and B vitamins included, sometimes some other vitamins and minerals. Over the years, the macrobiotic diet has kind of evolved to become a little bit more liberal. There are some nice aspects of the macrobiotic diet, including plants, lots of fruits and vegetables, but certainly there can be some real deficiencies with following a strict macrobiotic diet. There is not any scientific evidence that has been proven to that the macrobiotic diet will cure cancer. There are a lot of testimonials on the internet, but there really is not any scientific evidence to demonstrate effectiveness of a macrobiotic diet. So if you can work with a dietitian to find a diet that does incorporate some of those good aspects of the macrobiotic diet, but also really preventing the deficiencies that are of concern, that would be my recommendation.
Excellent. Thank you. We do have a question from one of our online participants. And the question is, what kinds of biomarker tests are available to today's patients that can determine whether a treatment offered has a better chance of success? Dr. O'Reilly, could you address that in a general way?
Yeah, so that's a very topical and good question. Is, are there tests that we can do either on a patient's blood or on their tumor to help define what would be the best treatment for that person? And I'd love to say that the answer to that question is yes in 2012, but we're not there yet, although there are certain hints that certain molecular aspects of the tumor may point in certain directions. So for many clinical trials and some of the types of studies that Dr. Bhattacharya was talking about, these kinds of tests are built in to learn to see, do they have value in predicting what might be a way of refining treatment for a person. So we have some hints. And for example, one of them is RAS mutations occur very frequently and perhaps almost universally in people with pancreas cancer. And there are certain drugs that may not be able to work because of the presence of that mutation. That is not a validated statement as yet in pancreas cancer, but there's work underway to clarify that question. A second type of biomarker may be a genetic biomarker in terms of a subset of people who are diagnosed with pancreas cancer that may have a change or a mutation in their genes that may have predisposed to the cancer in the first place. An example here would be a BRCA1, 2, or PALB2 mutation. And for that group of patients, we know they may be particularly susceptible to certain medications such as platinum drugs, and possibly and speculatively experimental drugs called PARP inhibitors, and that's an active area of research. So they would be, those two would be examples of emerging biomarkers. there have been some others used to try and refine gemcitabine treatment, and some of those are based on genetic analysis of how gemcitabine is broken down in the body that have some potential promise. Some others have been based on the tumor itself and have recently looked less promising. So I think a lot more to come in this area, and again, a very, very active area of research.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Excellent question. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Kathleen S. Your line is open.
Yes. I'm a nurse, and I'm seeing a patient presently with pancreatic cancer, and she's having a really difficult time with gas, bloating, abdominal pain right in the mid-abdomen. She is taking Creon 12,000 units with the beginning of a meal. But I'm wondering if, you know, the doctor would address, number one, about more detail about the pancreatic juices. How do we know that she really needs Creon? And number two, is there any way that a stent could be placed in the area that is her cancer, by the way, is at the head of the pancreas, that could put in a stent so that the juices would maybe flow and make her more comfortable?
Well, thank you for that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Bharattacharya to address your question in a general way, and then, of course, we will suggest that you take that back to your entire medical team and see if they, you know, if that those guidelines might be helpful to you. So, Dr. Bharattacharya, could you just address this in a general way that might be helpful?
Sure, and actually this is a lot to do with nutrition too, so Maria should chime in because you mentioned she is on Creon, so the first question would be whether the Creon dose is sufficient, is she taking it appropriately, is she lactose intolerant with that, so I'll have Maria touch on that as well. But when it comes to gas and bloating, we need to be careful about thinking of blockage with these symptoms. Most patients, if we are concerned about blockage where a stent would be beneficial, or a G-tube, which is a tube that we would place to drain the gastric juices, would be beneficial, is a very different situation. That most patients, I would say, 80%+ patients have nausea and vomiting. And so the gas and bloating symptom if there is a deficiency, it's more of a pancreatic juice deficiency. The stent placement and the tube placement that I talked about, that is a blockage with the gastric juices then backing up and causing the nausea and vomiting. So the stent will not take care of this problem. Now, sometimes if there is intestinal blockage from involvement of the membrane, the lining of the bowel with carcinomatosis, yes, there could be gas and bloating related to that, but usually that's multifocal and a stent, again, may not be beneficial for that. The first thing to look into here would be to address the a pancreatic insufficiency and see whether that is an issue. Also, if there is any paresis related to intestinal slowing down and motility, one could consider some of these motility agents that we use, one being Reglan, which can help some of our patients. So I think one would need a little bit more understanding of where the symptom is coming from. It's not common to consider a duodenal stent, but I would definitely want Maria to chime in.
Certainly. So the Creon dose, in general, the patients may require a fairly high dose of Creon. So the maximum dose for Creon is actually 10,000 lipase units per kilogram per day. So at a dose of Creon, 12,000 lipase units, that can be upwards of 30 or 40 pills maximum per day. Now, most patients don't need that amount. Typically, what I've seen with the Creon 12,000 is that patients need somewhere between 3 and 4 capsules with a regular size meal. So if the patient's just taking one Creon with each meal, then it's certainly working with the physician to try increasing that dose of Creon may be helpful. Also, the timing of the Creon can be important. We generally start patients by taking the Creon just with the start of the meal, with the first bite of food, but oftentimes spreading that Creon out throughout the meal can be very helpful and mimic really the pancreas's natural rhythm of producing the enzymes and emptying those into the GI tract throughout the course of a meal. So I think it's definitely worth looking into the amount of prion that she's utilizing.
Thank you very much, and I want to thank you for these wonderful questions. I want to thank all of our speakers for really giving such wonderful, you know, answers to some of the questions that were asked. I want to thank everyone for participating today. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program and that you can access further services from Cancer Care by calling 1-800-813-HOPE and contacting our social work staff here. We don't want you to feel alone. Know that you're part of Cancer Care's community of support. Give us a call. We're here to help you. Thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.